Rumpus time is over.
There's a new sheriff in town.
Luke's crazy.
Did you hear that, Brian?
Luke, we're gonna have company!
Brian! Bad guys of the galaxy, beware! The defender of the universe is here!
In order to form a more perfect union.
Luke! Brian!
Luke Bryan's!
One margarita, two margarita, three margarita shot.
Stop that! You're not going into a song while I'm here.
And now for something completely different.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Talking Heads.
Hello and welcome. Happy Tuesday afternoon, everyone out there in the listening audience. You are listening to Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian, minus the Brian on this fine afternoon, but joined in the Solidarity Realty Studios by my friend, William Walter. Will, how you doing this Tuesday afternoon?
What is up, party people? I am doing great, and I am very happy to have brought such beautiful weather on this Tuesday because I made sure that I'm not coming at the end of the week. That's not on me, everybody.
We had to make sure that we're clear
that's not on me.
We had to squeeze you in before the blizzard warnings that we got for later in the week across the state of Wisconsin. So appreciate you joining me here in studio this Tuesday afternoon. We got Evan on the board producing, as always, with those fine magical fingers on the ones and twos. We appreciate you, Evan. Nice wave for the people there watching on Devil Radio 92.7 FM's Facebook page. You can check out the live stream there. You're also listening to the program on the Shaw 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM in Waukesha, and across the Civic Media Network, Oshkosh Air Support in Oshkosh, Lake Aaron Amory, radio from the Center in Richland Center, and locally grown radio in Wisconsin Rapids. If you want to join the show, share a tangent with us on this Tuesday afternoon, 844-967-2789. You're going to want to go ahead and get those calls in early because we will be joined by Reverend Everett Mitchell, the Honorable Reverend Everett Mitchell, Dane County Circuit Court Judge, running for the State Supreme Court next year. Will be joining us at 2:30 for a conversation, getting to know him a little bit better, and hear about what led him to running for the State Supreme Court in that race that will have a lot of focus on it. Already numerous candidates. It's going to be a very interesting primary leading up in February and the general in April, and really appreciate you helping out and getting that booking for us here on Dueling Tangents, Will.
Well, you're not going to want to, you definitely don't want to miss that. Everett is perhaps my favorite candidate in the state going back years and years and years. He is just a phenomenal person. Any opportunity you have to meet him, any event that he's at, I highly suggest taking it. He is just such a good conversation.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled that he will be joining us at 2:30 so we can have that conversation here on the airwaves on Dueling Tangents. Again, the number to call if you want to share a tangent with us on this Tuesday afternoon, 844-967-2789. But Will, we've got an interesting update before we have that conversation with Judge Mitchell. The city of Milwaukee today announced that they are going to be challenging the census results for the city. Mayor Cavalier Johnson announcing that they are going to contest what he contends was an undercount. And, I mean, this is pretty interesting because the 2020 census, again, took place during the pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic hit, and there were concerns of how accurate the census would be, mm-hmm. whether individuals would be answering their doors or the flyers in the mail that would come to all residents in 2020 because of the census and because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There were worries of an undercount. And Mayor Cavalier Johnson is saying, yes, the U.S. Census Bureau undercount the city of Milwaukee's population by thousands.
The numbers are astounding, Luke. The city evidently lost nearly 3% of its population over the course of 10 years, leaving it at the lowest population since 1930.
Yeah, and there have been pushes for, if you're paying attention to what's going on in Milwaukee right now, folks, there are some out there that want to make Milwaukee a million-person city. They are striving for that. And so the 2020 numbers were a very large bump in the wrong direction when it came to where the city was trending. And so, yes, a 3% drop, according to the 2020 official count. But Mayor Johnson is saying that that's an undercount. And the ramifications of that undercount are pretty huge as well. And so reading from a piece over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, written up by Allison Dyer and Vanessa Swalls. The mayor is pretty much saying that the declining population is not correct, and that this 3% drop is not real, but in fact an undercount, and the population pretty much stayed stagnant. But if you take the way that the census comes through government funding, but also appropriation. So the way that the maps were drawn, taken for our 2020, the entire redistricting fight that was underway last year and still could be ongoing.
Is.
Yeah, it's still ongoing. Those maps, that process took the 2020 census. That's what we were waiting for. That's what the delays were early last year of the map drawing process, because we were waiting for those 2020 census numbers to come in. And if the city is undercounted by 3%, Will, this could make all the difference in the appropriation and the lines. And you got to throw out those maps then, because if there's a true undercount of that large, that has a lot of different political consequences for the representation and the way that the city of Milwaukee is represented.
Now, will the current Supreme Court throw those maps out? Probably not. But again, that's why this race in April is so important. The excellent JS Online article also pointed out Milwaukee's not the only city that's currently undergoing this, right? Boston and Detroit are as well. So this undercounting issue might have been something that we're seeing at the national level. A good friend of the show, Dan Schaefer, also pointed out that the estimated undercount is roughly equivalent to the total population of all of Pewaukee, nearly 17,000 people. That is a major, major difference.
Yeah. Yeah. 17,000 people missing for formulas that take into consideration population for federal funding, for the way that maps are drawn and how you're represented in either your city, your county, your state. This matters, and having an error that large is a pretty big deal. And so, yes, this city of Milwaukee is not unique. There are other cities that are facing these same challenges, and I'm not certain of the way that this goes forward, but getting an accurate count of residents in a city like Milwaukee, I think is vital. And the fact that the mayor is now going to challenge these results is very, very crucial.
Well, and that goes deeper than politics. That kind of seems like the first thing that a successful society would do is figure out how many people we have participating. Like, that's it. Step one, what are we going to do? How many people do we have? Everything else comes out of that, because, like you said, the policies that go into how we're distributing our resources, just the raw data of knowing who is where and how many people are in each community is so vital. It's kind of gross to me that they could be this far off if the reports are accurate.
And the big thing is, Will, of who got undercounted.
Exactly. And I'm sure it's just coincidence that it's Milwaukee again, right?
Well, not even that it's Milwaukee, but who in Milwaukee was responsible for the undercount, because that is a large reason as well of why this needs to be corrected. And this is reading farther down in the piece over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but the city of Milwaukee population closer to 593,722, this city argues. The census undercount the total housing units by 2,394 and likely overcounted vacant units by about 4,000 for a total of roughly 15,800 people, Johnson wrote in a 5-page letter to the U.S. Census Bureau Director Robert Santos. They also argued about 700 people held in Milwaukee County Jail downtown were instead counted as being in custody at the Milwaukee County House of Corrections in Franklin. In all, they believe Milwaukee's April 1st, 2020 population was approximately 593,722, and they say the undercount occurred primarily in communities of color, specifically in the Black and Hispanic populations based on the Census Bureau's own post-count analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that those are the areas that were undercounted even further requires this to be addressed. Because if you had a 3% undercount everywhere across the board, the city of Milwaukee all the way up to Bayfield to Green Bay or around the state of Wisconsin, it wouldn't necessarily matter as much. If we were off by 3% across the board, But when you're off by 3% in the areas that should be receiving the resources, they need to be receiving the same amount of resources as everywhere else. And if that's the only area that was undercounted in this undercount for the city of Milwaukee, that needs to be addressed. And so the Census Bureau, I'm curious to know how these corrections are going to be fixed, if they're going to wait a decade to adjust for them, or if there is things that can be, steps that can be taken between now and then, because waiting 8 years for these communities to receive the federal resources, the state resources that they deserve for those accurate numbers not being accurate, I think it's pretty ridiculous, Will, that this is the same. It happens over and over and over again. We
marginalizing the same communities over and over and over
again. And the fact, and some people out there on the right side of the aisle, Republicans, conservative-minded people, are like, why are you always talking about race? Well, I'm sorry. If it's the same communities over and over and over again that are receiving the short end of the stick, it absolutely needs to be talked about.
They don't want us to see race because then we won't see the patterns of them abusing people based on their race.
The fact that the minority communities in Milwaukee were the severely undercounted communities has ramifications. And the fact that this is coming out 2 years after the fact, I am very grateful that Mayor Cavalier Johnson is going ahead and contesting these census results. But man, how did it... We have to keep talking about this because otherwise errors like this keep happening. And so the city of Milwaukee... contesting these census results from the 2020 census, saying that the city was undercount by roughly 17,000 people.
And the maps, you know, earlier this year, for example, Common Council Committee decided to move forward with an aldermanic map that had been previously vetoed, and Latino rights leaders are calling on city officials to stop the reapproval of the map. Remember that they were pushing for a third majority district, and it was not granted, despite the fact that Latinos and Hispanics represent 20.1% of the city's population. So this is a large demographic that is being systemically underrepresented time and time again.
While all this happened, we've got stories about a congressman that maybe doesn't really exist. We're going to get into that story next. Folks, you're listening to Dueling Tangents with Luke and Will this Tuesday afternoon. We're going to be right back.
The count. They call me the count because I love to count things.
Sam is bad at this.
Welcome back to Dueling Tangents. You want to join the show? Share a tangent with us on this Tuesday afternoon, 844-967-2789. You can call or text that number. You're listening across Civic Media. If you want to learn more about what we're doing here at Civic Media, go to our website, civicmedia.us. You can learn more about Dueling Tangents and the other excellent programming the station puts out, as well as you can see a list of all the stations, a coverage map of our stations around the state of Wisconsin, and you can sign up to learn more about where the next station may be popping up closest to you. Again, the website, civicmedia.us. I'm joined here in the Solidarity Realty Studios by William Walter. And, Will, it's pretty interesting. We get an undercount that large, 3% undercount for the city of Milwaukee. And then, again, it's important to put this into context. 3% less funding for roads, for highways, for schools, like, everything that the federal government uses population for in their funding models, 3% less if a city as large as Milwaukee is undercounted like that.
And to give you some raw numbers, Senator Chris Larson pointed out on Twitter about an hour ago that $21 million in funding is at stake, including about $14 million for MPS, and that's not even beginning to cover the fair representation in the legislature.
Exactly. So drastic results of what that undercount would mean for the city of Milwaukee, excuse me. And the important step that Mayor Cavalier Johnson is taking to refute those results of the census from 2020. But another interesting story popping up and kind of like an undercount. you know, kind of not realizing maybe what was there or what wasn't there, is this story that kind of caught my eye. And when you and I were prepping for what we wanted to discuss on today's big show, it caught your eye as well. And so this story written up over at NPR is where we're reading from. But this is an interesting case of a congressman that...
Congressman-elect,
yes. He was elected last month. But now, after the votes have been counted, some people are kind of going through his bio, Will, and not seeing, or at least not able to confirm, who he says he is.
Well, and it's considered serious enough that Joseph Cairo Jr., the influential chairman of Nassau County's Republican Committee, said that the allegations of having faked much of his biography are, quote, very serious. I believe he deserves an opportunity to address these claims detailed in the article. But the official biography, it goes on to state a number of accomplishments in the congressman-elect, whose name is George Santos. A number of career accomplishments that, frankly, have no history, or any of the institutions that allegedly provided this have come out and said that it's just not true. Baruch, am I pronouncing that correctly? I don't think so, but college in New York that he evidently graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics and finance have come out and said that they could not find a match for this individual. He also frequently points out to his success outside of politics as an example of, you know, someone who accomplished the American dream, which is why I deserve to be your elected representative. Mm-hmm. Quotes from him such as, I'm a private sector guy who was born and raised in abject poverty. Only in this country does someone who comes from a basement apartment in Jackson Heights like I did is able to rise to become a successful business person to then run for the United States Congress. He cites as professional experience having worked for Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, you know, some of the most powerful, most successful firms in the country. Well, both of those companies told the New York Times when asked that they had no record of Santos working for their firms, as the candidate had claimed. A Citi spokesperson said that they were unable to confirm his employment with Citi, and the Goldman Sachs spokesperson told NPR, quote, we have no record of his employment.
Just undercounting the employment, that's all.
Right.
That's all that is. Come on.
That's a much healthier way to phrase it, right? You know, he also claimed in an interview with WNYC Public Radio last month that some of his former employees died in the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting, which appears to not be the case. And the New York Times investigation could find no link from any of those 49 victims or companies that they had worked with, no links to George Santos whatsoever. So
kind of just a serial liar that ran for Congress, was elected to Congress, and now it's going to be pretty interesting to see what happens. If I want to know who he actually is, because if everything that he ran on is a lie, I think he owes it to the voters in his district to probably step down.
I'm curious how he was able to cover it up so well for so long. Why did his opponent not look into this?
There are some critiques of the way that the campaigns were ran for his opponent. The Oppo research that was done, there was the notes of this. Apparently, the local outlets had been reporting on it throughout the elective cycle, but it didn't really get picked up in New York, Will. And so the ramifications of what this means could be pretty large as well, though. Remember, Republicans only have a 4-seat majority in the House of Representatives.
Ironically, because of the New York Democratic Party. But we won't get into that.
Right,
we've talked about that.
That's a tangent
before.
For another day. We don't have nearly enough time in this segment to be able to dive into that one. But right now, Kevin McCarthy can only lose 4 votes. The 5th vote that he loses could lose him votes. He couldn't get the speakership. He couldn't get things passed without keeping those voters and in the House of Representatives. And so the fact that this shadow candidate kind of mystery man now exists, it's pretty interesting to see. Are Republicans going to kind of circle the wagons and back him up as a member of Congress elect, or will there be accountability for the voters in his district that he steps down and resigns, and then all of a sudden we have the focus of a special election in New York State for a even slimmer majority? If Kevin McCarthy loses it, it will be interesting to see what happens, but it's definitely...
Well, he's going to struggle to get to 218 even with the four-seat majority.
That's what I'm saying.
He's in the Freedom Caucus.
He's having a hard time. It's not even the Freedom Caucus. It's some of the outright just crazies. Folks, you're listening to Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. You want to join the show, 844-967-2789. We're going to be joined by Judge Everett Mitchell coming up next. So stay tuned across Civic Media. We'll be right back. To live this way. Welcome back to Dueling Tangents. If you want to join the show, you can follow us on Twitter at Dueling Tangents. You can follow Civic Media at Civic Media US. You can call or text 844-967-2789. But right now we are joined by Judge Everett Mitchell, the Honorable Reverend Everett Mitchell, joining us here in studio. Judge Mitchell, how are you doing on this Tuesday afternoon?
Man, I will tell you that this is, it's been kind of crazy today, because as I was getting ready to come here, we were with my son's godmother, and so her car wouldn't start. So then I had to go from like driving over there real fast, pulling out my cables, jump starting her car, make sure her car was right, then get back in the car, head back over here from Woodman. So yeah, it's been a very adventurous morning.
Of course, right? The one course. Day you need everything to go well, it's like, nah, not today.
Not today at all.
It is that time of year, though, where you have to be ready to jump a car or have your car jumped. And you got to have one of those friends that it's not too far away that's like, oh, yeah, I can come with some of the cables and get you started.
My trunk is filled with kitty litter now in case I get stuck in the snow somewhere. So.
Yeah, so, it's that time of the year where you got to know. And you got to have a friend who know what to do. So you're not looking at the cable. What do we do with the red and the black? What do we do with this?
Which one's first?
How do I do it? Scott! You don't want people to be electrocuted.
Now you've compounded that issue, right? Now you got to stop at the hospital, and then you can go back to what you were doing before. It's just one thing after another.
So, at least that's one thing I can say. I did mechanics when I was younger. My grandfather taught me how to do cars, so that's at least one thing I'm always familiar with.
Nice. I had a 1995 Honda Civic for a real long time. Drove that one into the ground, so I learned early how to ground the battery and restart that when you needed a jump. So,
there you go.
But we're not talking necessarily the vehicles and everything like that. We're having you in here today because you, sir, are on the ballot for the state Supreme Court race that is coming up next February. Is the primary, the April general election. And so, really appreciate you joining us here. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you decided to jump into the race and what you're running for the state Supreme Court for.
Yeah, well, I thank both of you all for having me on today. I think, when we think about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, I'm running because I believe our state deserves justice that reflects the diversity and ideas of our entire state. I've been running on this idea that justice is not what you say, justice is what you do. So my commitment to public service has been whether working with men and creating a program called The Journey Home, working with men and women coming out of prison that reduce recidivism rate from 70% down to 15%, working to change the rules related to CCAP, which is a circuit court automated website that people can go in so that people who have charges that are dismissed or they've been found now guilty, or if there's an eviction that has been dismissed, they can have those things removed from CCAP. Or even leading the charge to, take handcuffs and restraints off of children and reorganize our system so that we can see that, in order to, to stop being the state that leads the nation in disparities related to incarceration, that we need to reprioritize how we think about the processes that we do for our young people so that we're not feeding more young people into the adult system. So I call that the dismissing or diminishing and getting rid of the child welfare to juvenile delinquency to adult prison pipeline. So I'm running because I believe our state needs a justice that is not pulled by partisanship. Just like there should be a separation between church and state, there should be a separation between partisanship and justice. And I think there's no other candidate that's going to bring a life experience that is as both complex and positive and triumphant as the one I'm going to bring to the state. And as I said last night when I was talking to a group in La Crosse, I said, I may not have been born in Wisconsin, but I chose it because it is a state that I believe that the values reflect my own and it's worthy to defend.
Fantastic. And so this is, judges are an interesting instance here in the state of Wisconsin. We do elect them four terms. And so we have an interesting dynamic of the judiciary. And I do appreciate you bringing that up right off the bat of saying there needs to be a nonpartisan divide from how we get judges on the ballot and elect them, but then also how they sit on the bench and oversee the cases that come before them. You have been elected here in Dane County on the circuit court overseeing overseeing the juvenile program for the fourth branch. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences and you touched on them already with the removing of handcuffs for juveniles in court rooms. But what has the process been like before for here in Dane County, and how have you seen that translate to running statewide instead of just on the county circuit court here?
So one of the things that I can flesh out a little bit more is that when I took over as the presiding judge over the Duty Division, which means that I'm, you know, oversee a whole process of CHIPS and juvenile delinquency, one of the main things that I really want to focus on is how we do our processes and making sure that they're the adequate resources at every level of the intervention. So whether it's the child welfare side or juvenile delinquency side, you know, and that leads into the adult. I also run a high-risk drug court program. So I get this whole spectrum of how that if we don't do the interventions correctly, we're literally sending children that end up in our community, in foster home, you know, with adoptions, or sometimes just moving from group home to treatment facilities, residential treatment facilities. And if we don't get the services quickly to them up front, between the ages like 4 and 6 or 4 and 8, then we're then passing that trauma on to a juvenile delinquency system. And then we have to figure out how do we listen to the people, young people then, to deliver them those services so that we're not sending more of them into the adult system.
You're setting them up for failure unless you reach them young. Right?
Man, listen, some people say, well, Judge, what is the proper age? Is it, you know, 13? Is it 10? I say, listen, it is as young as you can get them, because we got kids who are removed from home, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old. And they're receiving, you know, so much trauma by the age of 4, you would not believe. Mm-hmm. And so we have to make sure we target those interventions, not only to give interventions for those young people directly, which means I want to make sure that they have treatment, because we weren't doing that. We would give parents treatment, but we wouldn't give the kids treatment. I'm like, if you move a kid 2 or 3 times, that's enough trauma in their young life. You need to make sure they can process that. And then, you know, we can get in-home services. So, you know, reworking those systems have not only impacted what we do on a local level, but it's also something that I'm trying to make sure we can implement on a statewide as well. So when I was over in Milwaukee this weekend with the community brainstorming session, that's what we talked about. How do we translate what we're doing here in Dane County to statewide so that we can give statewide partners the information that I give to our community, make sure that same information is delivered statewide so that we all have the same operation of what we're trying to accomplish for our entire state.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one thing you mentioned at the beginning that I really want to touch on, because this is one of my favorite aspects of the work that you're doing, is I guess the problem is that the criminal justice system in the United States, a lot of people see it as revenge, right? You committed this crime and you have to pay society back. But conceptually, that's not the point. It's supposed to be about rehabilitation, getting people who made a mistake, the knowledge and the ability to be able to be reintegrated in society. And I know you've done a lot of work in terms of job programs, preparations. Would you like to touch on that briefly? Because I think that is just one of the absolute coolest things in your line of work.
So what I did even before I became a judge, that's why I talked about that program we created called The Journey Home, which was really built on the principle of called REST. Now we call it RESET, which is residence, employment, support, treatment, transportation, education. So people needed those pillars. And when we wrote the program, we listened to all these individuals who said what they needed. And so what we did, we started when they were inside the prisons, and we would work with those resources. And we would use, you know, coordinate with the landlord association, work with employers, probably more the trade unions, because those were more flexible employment opportunities. Made sure that they had support options in the community, and then made sure their treatment was set up, whether it's ALDA treatment, mental health treatment, and we connect those services. So, you know, people thought it was magic, but it really wasn't.
It's not magic. No, you're just putting time and effort.
I was
just saying,
that's a lot of hard work. That calling it magic is erasing all of the hard work that goes into that process.
Thank you. It was very time consuming, but it was, and so creating those networks so that people when they came out, didn't fall to the concrete. And because if people fall to the concrete, they go start using drugs again. They'll be back in the criminal nature again. More victims going to be harmed. So for me, this was a harm reduction model.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, because we
the
can do both.
The system perpetuates itself. If you don't give the people the ability to reintegrate naturally,
yes,
of course they're going to end
gonna
up in
right
the
back.
Same situation that yep. they were in.
And then the reverse happens. So now as a judge, I'm saying to myself, I don't even want to send them to that system. Like, because if I have to send it to that system, one, you're dependent upon the system to actually have the resources to, you know, mitigate against some very complicated mental health cases. And then secondly, that means if they in the system, that means more victims have been harmed in the process. So how do we just make sure that they don't, you know, hurt people hurt more people? So how do we make sure that these hurting young people don't end up hurting more people as they're trying to grow up and, you know, age out of this system? I can say that what we have done in Dane County is really given a model, because we went down from 4 judges to 3 because we no longer have the cases to justify having 4 bodies. And we've seen, you know, like, you know, 40% decrease in stolen car rates. We've seen, you know, like 85% of our young people, they don't come back. Right.
And that's truly a sign of success of the program.
That
should be the goal. Like, if they don't come back, that means that they got it. They learned the lesson. They're not coming back, right?
You did your job at that point.
Yeah, yeah. We all did our job,
yes.
Right?
Everybody.
Everybody mm-hmm. collectively came together, you know. But what makes it different is when a judge steps into the conversation and says, this is what we need for our community. This is what I'm saying. I know other people study what we do, but this is what I'm saying on the ground every day, and we must attack this stuff in order to make sure that we're not adding more bodies and more victims through the adult system.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, you're listening to Dueling Tangents. We are joined by the Honorable Reverend Judge Everett Mitchell here in the Solidarity Realty Studios. Judge Mitchell running for State Supreme Court on the ballot this upcoming spring, 2023. It's going to be a February primary. And a lot of what we've been dealing with over the last 2 years, there's been an increased focus on criminal justice and the way that the system is supposed to be working and how it's designed and how it's not designed for everybody to succeed. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of reckoning. There's been very heated sides on a lot of different directions. People come to this argument from all over, between the unrest that was on State Street throughout the summer of 2020 and onward. This has been a core of the conversation. And we've been seeing, even this last election cycle in 2022, the notion of cash bail and the left versus the right, and is it right or is it wrong, and how do we be able to better improve these systems? Because as you're saying, the system is supposed to work and not return individuals back into the system.
The goal should be rehabilitation.
And I believe another goal needs to be a human aspect of it as well, to try to make it work and not punish individuals for, say, not having the money to be able to post bail. And so this has been a pretty big topic of cash bail, but I'd love to hear your stance on improvements where we could fix the system to better reflect society rather than what we've been dealing with over the last couple of years.
Yeah, so just so your listeners will always know my stance on this, I've always... I have not supported the elimination of cash bail, but you got to hear me out as to why. One, I think if you eliminate cash bail, what you're doing is removing a tool that judges can use to be able to give access to people to be released. To remove that tool, you're then leaving it up to the discretion of a judge to assess dangerousness or not. To me, that will add to the disparities, not lessen them. I think the reforms that we really need to have, because I think what we're trying to get at is that certain people are low income, they're poor, and if they had the same privilege as somebody else, then they could be able to bond out at $100, $150. And that $150 may hold a person in custody, and they're being effectively punished because they don't have means to be able to get out. So I think that there are a couple of things I've always advocated for. One, we need more reviews. So people, if for whatever reason, some judge or commissioner, and mostly it's commissioners, feel like...
We just got about a minute here until the break. So continue on, though. I apologize. As I was asking the question, I was like, I don't know if we're going to have enough time. But
we can always come back after the break.
Yeah, I was just saying, we're going to come back to this after the break. But Folks, you're listening to Dueling Tangents. We're joined by Everett Mitchell here in the studio, Judge Everett Mitchell, running for state Supreme Courts this upcoming spring, 2023. And very important conversations to be having. So really appreciate you joining us here in the studio today. We are going to continue the conversation around cash bail. If you want to join the show, share a tangent, 844-967-2789. You can call or text that number. And we really appreciate you being here. We're going to continue this conversation when we get back on the other side of this commercial break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Dueling Tangents. Thank you, Evan, for that intro back. We are joined, first off, by Will Walters here joining me in studios, filling in for Brian as he is out this Tuesday afternoon, and Judge Everett Mitchell joining us as well here in the Solidarity Realty Studios. And before we had to go to that break, we had you begin to touch on your stance on cash bail, and so if you kind of summarize those 2 points that you got to make before, and then if you'd like to continue on your stance on where you are on cash bail.
Yeah, so I've been a big advocate of reforming our bail system. One, like I said, more frequent reviews for people who are low income, making sure that they're being brought back into our court system to review their circumstances after that initial bail has been determined. Secondly, to enhance our pretrial services. There's a lot of pretrial services where we get information, and sometimes we get that information, sometimes we don't. But it's important to get as much information about an individual as we can while we're making that bail determination. And then thirdly, to make sure that we advocate for men and women who are charged to actually get assigned a public defender at the time, even before they have been formally charged, the moment that they're being arrested, because that's where the disparity becomes in those court hearings, where you have someone who can afford an attorney, can have an attorney learn about their history, where they work, family, ties, community, know how to shape an argument. You can't get that shaping of an argument with the 30 seconds that a public defender that's just been assigned to cover that day is going to meet with someone, right? So it is not only the money aspect of bail in general, but it's the fact that individuals really don't have an advocate, especially if you're low income. Because most times the way the public defender works is, if you're low income, you're not assigned until after you're charged. And I think the crisis that we're facing right now is because of how COVID stopped criminal courts. You now have people who are waiting months for an attorney to be assigned to them while they still sit in jail. So yes, we can have an argument about bail, which is legitimate, but we also need to have a conversation about what do we do with individuals whose constitutional rights are being in many ways eroded because they don't even have an attorney to have their cases being heard so they could be determined whether or not to bond it over or not for future hearings.
And I think that's what you just touched on is a lot of the concept of the two-tiered system of justice that we hear all the time, right? There are reasons that these kind of phrases exist because the system does have a lot of flaws that it's so refreshing to hear someone touch on them from an honest perspective of, I have lived through it, I have witnessed it, these are the issues that I've seen. And, you know, nobody has all the answers, right? Nobody can sit here and say, I know exactly what we should do, we need to do X, Y, Z. That's the purpose of community. We all come together to find the best way to power forward. Now, with you in particular, Everett, something that we touched on briefly over the break, I absolutely have loved hearing about the experiences in your life that have driven you to become the person that you are today and to see the system through your eyes. Would you care to touch on some of that? A brief history of Everett Mitchell, your background, what led to the person you are today?
Yeah, man, I'm, you know, son of a single mother. My mother eventually married a guy who was abusive sexually. He abused my sister for 12 years and then physically abused me as well. I'm a victim of sexual abuse myself. And so trying to, you know, save my sister from that damage led me to a place when I got ready to graduate from high school and actually got some help from a teacher. I was functionally illiterate. And so even though I got a I got a call from a small school in Texas to come give college a try. I had taken a job bagging groceries. I thought, you know, your next Wisconsin Supreme Court justice was going to be bagging groceries, which is, you know, it's all good. But I got that call and they said, come try a college. I did. Nobody in my family had been to school, so we threw everything in the trunk. Went down to East Texas. I failed everything, but I had two wonderful teachers, Miss Daisy Wilson and Miss Margaret Bell. Shout out to Miss Bell. She just passed. Love you. And I know she's watching over me. And they taught me how to read. They taught me how to study. They told me the discipline of how to study. And then I eventually went from, you know, failing, like making a 1.5 to making a 4.0 in one semester, and then eventually transferring to Morehouse College. And then eventually, having 2 degrees from Princeton and then earning my Juris Doctorate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, it's those experiences of, you know, living my life, being homeless. And when you're homeless and you don't have a place to live, how that impacts how you think about people. When you, you know, when you have to depend on other people to help you, you learn humility and you learn grace.
And so, you've given that back. You've shown through your dedication to both youth and the rehabilitation of the incarcerated that if you put the time and resources and love and effort into these people, they can find their footing and they can be superstars in the modern world.
I tell the kids that I'm not only your judge, I'm also your reflection. That is a key indicator to them that, you know, we in this space together, but since you're in this space together, we're going to make the best of it so that you can have a future and don't hurt people anymore. You know, and I got to say this, I take a lot of time to spend with, you know, victims of pain so that they understand this process too. Just like you were saying, like there are a lot of people who don't understand it. So it's our job to make sure that they get an understanding of it and we take time to explain it.
Fantastic. And it's going to be a pretty interesting four-way race for state Supreme Court. And I believe you were one of the first, if not the first candidate in the pool for a nonpartisan race. And one of the aspects of here in Wisconsin is we know that all of these races are close. You've already touched on the fact that you were in La Crosse last night, Milwaukee the past weekend. How has it been like going around the state and communicating with Wisconsinites all over the entire state of your campaign to be their next state Supreme Court justice?
I would say it probably has become refreshing. As a black man traveling the state, the perception is that I will not be received. But I remember I was up in Barron County and I'd driven up there 4.5 hours and I was there and I went there to give a 7-minute, you know, campaign stump speech. And it's late and I'm the last speaker and it's getting dark. And the first thing they said to me was, you know, hey, Judge, why don't you come stay at the house? And I'm like, what? Are you
that
serious?
That famous Wisconsin hospitality,
man,
right? They'll give you a beer and some cheese,
we're going to get some beers. We don't want you to go back. We don't want you to worry about the deer. And I'm like, man, that's love, right?
Yeah.
That's love. So I think the perception is, you know, that the state is racist because of the ads that, you know, worked on Mandela. And I say this isn't about race. This is about connecting with people. I think when in Wisconsin, if you connect with people, people feel that energy and they feel that sense of humility and love. I think people in our state work hard and they're committed to their families, their faith, and fairness. And I think as long as I continue to convey that, you know, we find that connection together.
Absolutely. And the segments go quick here on a Tuesday afternoon. So if the listeners out there in the audience want to learn more about your campaign, we only got about a minute left of today's show. How can they go and find out more about you?
Go to judgemitchellforjustice.com. You can look on the website. We have wonderful videos and things that are about my career, and you can learn more about me that way. So I look forward to you learning and asking us questions, and we're always there to answer any concerns that our Wisconsinites may have.
I highly advise taking a peek at Judge Mitchell's website. It is very well done. I know I speak highly of him frequently on this program, but now that I got him here, I got to do it a little bit more in person.
Absolutely. Well, we really appreciate you joining us here on this Tuesday afternoon. Folks, you've been listening to Dueling Tangents. If you missed any portion of the show, go check out the podcast, civicmedia.us. Click on Dueling Tangents. We will be back tomorrow at 2 p.m. Talk to you then. Thanks so much, Will.
See you later, party people.
Thanks so much, Judge Everett.
Hi, Braylon. Say hi, Braylon. You about to get out.